Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court, Santino Chakoti on behalf of the appellant. I'm joined by co-counsel Nicole Walker and trial counsel Charles Oberle. This case is about a self-interested witness who engaged in a calculated and intentional outburst that jeopardized the defendant's right to a fair trial and could have sent an innocent man to prison. Secondly, this case is about the trial court's violation of appellant's right to fair trial and Sixth Amendment confrontation rights when it was denied an in-camera review by therapist statements that the complainants have made prior to trial. On the very first day of testimony, the complainant's father was called to the witness stand. And prior to taking the stand, the prosecutor had instructed him on what appropriate behavior was for the courtroom. Nonetheless, within seconds of his testimony, he rose up out of his chair, pointed to the defendant, and at a decibel level that could be heard outside the courtroom doors, said, "I wanted to know whether the girls had been raped. I wanted to know whether he stuck his penis in her vagina." Immediately, there was an objection, and trial counsel was told to be quiet. Following the jury being escorted out of the courtroom without a curative instruction, the court brought them back in prior to lunch. Again, no curative instruction. 2 hours had passed before they were told to disregard anything. When they did give a curative instruction, they did leave out the fact that it was calculated. And the significance of that is they were left with the notion that this was a natural emotional reaction and that trial counsel was unsympathetic to what the father had done. Now, this court reviews outbursts under the factors of Taylor. And those factors include the closeness of the case, the harm of the outburst, the adequacy of the instruction, and the closeness of the case. The state concedes this was a close case. It fits a close case paradigm. There was no physical evidence. Strictly the statements of the complainants.
Mr. Chakoti, let me ask you just one question.
Yes.
If the there had been a curative instruction given immediately after the outburst, would you still be claiming that there should have been a mistrial granted?
Yes, we do. And for the reason of the nature of the outburst, which is also one of the factors in Taylor.
Okay, so if the even if there had been an immediate curative given, it wouldn't matter as far as your side is concerned.
Because of the calculated, intentional nature of the outburst, yes.
Well, if I understand your position correctly, you seem to be saying that the fact that it was intentional puts it in a category that makes it more egregious. Is that correct?
It does. It does. This court has not addressed, at least from the case law that counsel could find, where such an outburst is premeditated as it was here. The record also indicates that the defendant was out on bail. And so the opportunities to say something in person were highly probable. The fact that the witness chose the courtroom as a forum in front of the jury rises to a level that warrants a mistrial. it violates the right to a fair trial.
Well, but what I'm concerned about is if the basic notion is we want to make sure there was a fair trial, why should it matter in terms of the analysis whether it was an intentional outburst or a natural outburst in terms of what the effect was and evaluating was a curative instruction enough and what the level of prejudice was from the outburst and those sort of things? Why does the intentional nature of it take on any particular importance?
Well, I think for the emotional aspect, I think it's important to look at the inverse. If the question is what separates this from one that's calculated. And in cases like this, and in numerous other types of cases, there's no doubt that witnesses are emotionally wrapped up in the case, and those comments are going to be elicited, or they're going to come out unresponsive. And that's what the rules try to, that's the analysis that's done, is what's the harm, what's the nature of the outburst. When it's premeditated, as it was here, there's an intentional nature to violate the trial right to the defendant. It goes beyond spontaneous and unpredicted to an intentional and planned method to violate someone's trial rights.
Let me see if I understand what actually happened here. As I understand the record, the trial judge specifically found that the remark was intentional. But she went on to make the finding, and I quote, that the remark was not calculated to in any way undermine the integrity of the court process. How do we review that ruling in the context of an abuse of discretion? She found that it was intentional, but she also concluded that whatever that intent may have been, it wasn't intentionally calculated to undermine the integrity of the court process. What does that mean, and how do we review it?
The standard of review is de novo for the reason that the appellant's Fifth Amendment rights were violated, his right to a fair trial. The state is contending that it's a abuse of discretion. Under both standards, it still warrants a finding of a mistrial. The record is clear, as Your Honor pointed out, that when, for the purpose of putting it on the record, the judge did say she found this to be calculated. And I believe her words were, and by calculated, I mean intentional, is what she said. And I think that's as clear as we can get as to the description.
Well, the distinction I'm trying to get clear in my mind is, it's calculated, it's an intentional in the sense that she found the witness knowingly and consciously stated it. But she then concluded that nevertheless, it, as a part of that mens rea or intent, it wasn't meant to undermine the entire process. And she believed, I assume, by denying a mistrial and by giving the curative instruction that she gave, and when she gave it, she clearly thought that she could preserve the fairness and integrity of the trial. Why is that incorrect?
Because when we look at the totality of the circumstances and the fact that she waited 2 hours to give a curative instruction, is tantamount to not giving an instruction at all. If we look at the outburst in a vacuum, it still rises to the level that warrants a mistrial. But the problem here was it was discussed by the prosecutor during closing. There were witnesses who testified after the outburst to the emotional value of, I believe the officer testified that he couldn't speak to the father. The outburst didn't stop there. There were numerous points that brought the jury back to the outburst, And by her waiting 2 hours to give an instruction at all is like giving no instruction at all.
Well, I probably should know the answer to this, but on those later occasions that you've just described when it was, in effect, represented to the jury, was a motion for a mistrial renewed?
No. And that's not what appellant is using those instances for, is the harm from the outburst. We understand that it was not objected at that point. But the fact that the seed was planted by the outburst and the prosecutor decided to pour water on the seed later on, that's the problem here. The harm in the context of the entire trial is what amplifies what occurred. The problem with the 2-hour delay is twofold. Number one, the opportunity was there. In fact, we know that the trial court could have done it sua sponte, because trial courts have done that when there's a outburst or whether there is, unsolicited comments. She could have done it sua sponte, but what's perplexing is when she took the jury out for the lunch break, she actually called the witness back in. And in essence, what she told the father, the witness, is what resembles a curative instruction. She gave it to the father, but not the jury. She told the father that these are things that the jury is only to consider the testimony and the evidence. That's what she should have told the jury on 2 occasions before sending them to lunch and bringing them back. And the option she had was not between nothing at all and a curative instruction. At the time, it was between a mistrial and a curative instruction. And we know that the trial judge was thinking about the curative instruction because she told the father, in essence, what the curative instruction was going to be.
Well, didn't the trial judge tell the jury, please do not allow yourself to be swayed by any emotion in this case. Your responsibility is to decide this case based upon the facts, the evidence, the testimony, any documents, the items that are introduced, and apply the law to that. And you are not by your oath to be swayed by any consideration other than the facts of the case and the evidence and the law, and to disregard any emotional outbursts. Wasn't that instruction given? And how's that?
You're referring to the actual curative instruction?
Yes.
Yes, that was 2 hours later. The argument is, the position is, it's too late. The damage has already been done. They had 2 hours for the outburst to ferment in their minds. This court has on numerous occasions held that it's prompt ameliorative instructions that cure this type of commenting.
Not in this case, correct?
Not of this case.
I mean, your answer to my question indicates that it doesn't matter in this case.
Exactly.
Whether the instruction had been given immediately after the outburst or 2 hours later.
That is correct. But one of the factors, the adequacy of the instruction, is when is it given?
In terms of evaluating the prejudice, doesn't the fact that the jury came back with some verdicts of lesser included offenses tend to suggest that the jury was not prejudiced by the outburst?
No, in fact, it's the opposite. The inconsistent verdict, the record indicates that the older sister and the younger sister had a common allegation that occurred with one of the assaults. And the allegation involved what happened to both of them. So the older sister account was, this happened to her and I, and then the younger sister, this happened to her and I. yet the jury disregarded entirely the older sister's account of what occurred. There were no convictions on the older sister. Now, surprisingly, the older sister is the complainant who initiated the allegations, and she did confide in numerous individuals before making the accounts, yet the jury disregarded her testimony.
You may want to consider whether you want to address your other 2 points.
Yes. Turning to the second issue, there is some common ground here between the state and the appellant, and that is that the privilege that is at issue can be pierced when constitutional issues are being alleged that have been violated. We also agree that when this is at issue, a balancing test is performed. Now, what we disagree with is obviously what has to rise to the level to pierce that privilege. In this case, numerous factors elevate the reason and the compelling reason as to why that privilege should be pierced. And that is, this case was predicated on credibility. That was the sole issue. The statements that appellant was seeking were specific. We know they occurred. The record indicates that the complainants did meet with a psychiatrist prior to trial. And we know that there were vagueness and inconsistencies throughout the course of the trial.
Well, what's your position with regard to the threshold or standard you'd have to demonstrate to even have an in-camera inspection? Simply the fact that a therapist was consulted, or do you have to show more than that?
It depends on the context and the circumstances of the case. And the fact that the complainant's statements are what convicted the appellant, and what we're seeking to find in terms of exculpatory evidence and or impeachment evidence, or in fact statements by the complainants to test the credibility of them, that meets the threshold.
Well, that'll happen in every case where you consult a psychiatrist or a psychologist, won't it? There's always going to be a history and a description given by the patient.
With every case, I don't think so, because in this case, the central issue at trial was credibility. Is Your Honor's question whether in every credibility case?
Well, my question is related to Justice Hollins on the threshold. Every time a patient consults a psychiatrist or psychologist, there will be a history taken, and the fact that the patient describes the events of the alleged crime, does that satisfy the threshold or not?
If it goes to the heart of the case, it does meet the threshold. There's too much at stake when dealing with Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights. They must be pierced in situations like this, where those statements that Your Honor describes are the only set of statements that can be balanced with the testimony.
Then what is the trial judge to look for, assuming an in-camera inspection is done? Just whether a history was given?
whether there is a possibility that their statements could contain exculpatory or impeachment evidence for the defense.
In other words, whether the statement's disclosure is necessary to ensure a fair trial.
That is correct. I see that I'm into my rebuttal.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Please, right. Thank you.
Started your time yet.
Darn. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. Regarding the first issue of the witness outburst at trial, the state contends that the trial judge correctly found that under the Taylor-Pena factors that there was no need for to manifest necessity for a mistrial in this case.
Let's start at step one. Your friend says that the standard of review is de novo, and your brief suggests the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Which is correct and why?
Abuse of discretion, Your Honor, that is the standard of review normally used by this court in reviewing the court's decision on whether a mistrial is necessary when an objection is made and the factors are gone through. The court correctly applied the state's law regarding how to analyze a motion for a mistrial and correctly applied that to the facts. And
okay. It suggested to us, at least as I understand the opening argument, that when a trial judge finds that the outburst was intentional or calculated, that that somehow shifts the standard. Why would that be wrong?
There is no case law to support that proposition. And it is interesting to note that the first use of the word calculated came from defense counsel at trial, who, when objecting and requesting a mistrial, suggested that the outburst was not just simply emotional, it was calculated, it was clearly aimed at influencing the jury. The trial judge then picked up on that word and determined that, yes, it was calculated, but in fact, as Your Honor noted, explained the use of the word calculated to mean intentional. He meant to say what he said. That in other cases, although there's not been a finding on the record, it is I would suggest normally the case that people intend to say what they say, and that should not change the analysis in this case. The court specifically found that there was no intent to disrupt the process. This was an emotional case. It was very, in fact, the witness was testifying not on the first day of trial, but the second day of trial. There had already been a witness who had, in fact, cried and was upset. This was not the first emotion displayed during trial. The content was, in fact, neutral. There was no inadmissible evidence or prior bad acts alleged. It went to the state of mind of the witness. It was a single outburst. It was not accusatory. It was demonstrating what was in his mind. The verdict, in fact, supported the court's finding that there was not a likelihood that the jury would be misled or prejudiced in that the defendant was acquitted of four counts and of USC second, continuous sexual abuse related to one victim, received two lesser includeds, and the jury was hung on an additional count.
the state does not agree that this was an inconsistent verdict. Clearly, the jury did not find the one victim as credible in her testimony as the other, and it is certainly conceivable that the one count on which they hung related to that victim was the situation where they were both victims were discussing a single incident. The closeness of the case, it certainly hinged on credibility, but it was the credibility of the victims, not the father. So in this case, the witness who had the outburst was not the witness whose credibility was, in fact, at stake. And there was a curative instruction that was given by the judge, although it was not immediate, it was after the luncheon. The jury was brought back in, was immediately removed. When the jury was brought back in, they were reminded that testimony and the exhibits were the sole basis upon which you should decide this case.
Well, did the trial judge strike the words that your friend finds objectionable?
No, she did give them the curative instruction when they came back from lunch, however.
Was there any chance that they misunderstood because it wasn't stricken and thought that comment was part of the evidence?
Based on the verdict, no. It was clear that the defendant was never charged with the acts that the witness was questioning. And, in fact, that same witness, through his testimony, made that very clear that there was no allegation that the defendant had, in fact, stuck his penis in anyone's vagina. So that it was very clear throughout the trial that that was not an allegation. And certainly he could not have been convicted of something for which he was not charged. And the state would also contend that the trial judge is in the best position to make this determination, being there and being able to determine the reaction to the jury. As to the defense's position that, the appellant's position that further factors later on, subsequent to this in the trial, are relevant, those events had not happened when the judge made her initial finding that a mistrial was not necessary. Although there was a motion for a new trial in which this was again raised, in that motion, defense counsel did not allege that any subsequent trial events contributed to the prejudice regarding the mistrial.
When you mentioned that the trial judge is in the best position to gauge jury reaction, how do we review that unless there's some specific findings in the record about the factual basis that the trial judge indeed gauged the jury's reaction? Is there more here than just the statement that though the outburst was calculated, I find that it didn't, that the witness didn't intend to impugn the integrity of the process? Is there any factual basis to review to understand why the trial judge reached that conclusion?
Well, the record reveals that this was not the only emotional situation going on. It was an emotional case. There are a number of factors that would indicate
I mean something simpler, like what did the trial judge specifically find? Did she say on the record, among the bases that allow me to conclude that is the fact that I observed the jury reaction. I saw no reaction that I could gauge, or it was clear to me from the tone of the witness that it was simply an emotional outburst. It wasn't calculated to influence or prejudice the jury. Any kind of factual findings about those observations upon which you suggest we should put great faith in the trial judge's determination?
Well, other than the fact that she noted that clearly she believed that the statement was not designed to disrupt the proceedings,
Well, that's a conclusion. My question is, are there any factual findings that support that conclusion that's reviewable?
No.
Okay.
Well, if the outburst was inappropriate and the judge gave a curative instruction after lunch, why was there any reference to the outburst ever again during the course of the trial? Why would any reference to the outburst have been proper?
There was no reference to the outburst later in the trial. There was reference to the emotional trauma in the courtroom, which, given that several witnesses cried or had to take a break because of emotional levels, and that there was testimony concerning the emotional trauma related to the family and the problems that split up relatives within the family, the fact that the children were the alleged victims in the case, and that there it was a highly charged emotional case. There was never another reference to the outburst of this witness. Moving to the Rule 17 subpoena issue, as the appellant noted, the state agrees that there are cases where it is appropriate to pierce the privilege. This is not one of them. Once again, it is a question of what threshold a defendant needs to reach in order to seek access, to gain access, or have the court review privileged records in a criminal case. The state suggests that that is a high burden because the privilege is there and it is important and it should not lightly be invaded. And
well, can you give us an example? Well, first tell us what you think the burden should be, and then tell us how someone could meet the burden. If all the communications are privileged, it would seem by their very nature you wouldn't know much, if anything, about them for the purpose of coming forward and making your case.
In cases where there are, for example, if there was treatment of a psychiatric or other treatment, medical treatment, during the time period that the allegations relate to, that the incidents, the crimes were being committed, that would certainly show more, be of more interest than something that happened subsequent.
So also, you're saying if you, it's like a medical record. If you report to the emergency room and you describe your medical condition, but it includes facts relating to the crime, then maybe that would be discoverable without a showing. Now, we know in this case the treatment started, it was long after the investigation had been concluded. Or after the investigation had been concluded.
That's true, Your Honor. Also, if it goes to, if there's a question of the competency of a witness or victim witness as to what their ability to perceive events, to relate events, if they have a medical condition or a psychiatric condition which would affect their ability to have either perceived or to relate those events, that would be very important for a defendant to have access to something like that, where you actually have an issue of whether that witness is competent to relate those events or that you could impeach a witness with. Also, credible allegations of recantation would.
Why shouldn't we approach this in a fashion similar to the way confidential informants testimony is reviewed, where the defendant doesn't know whether the confidential informant might have some exculpatory evidence to provide, and typically it goes in front of the court for an in-camera review by the court to see whether there is any exculpatory evidence available from that confidential informant. I realize it's burdensome and all, but isn't that an important component of making sure that the defendant has a fair trial?
The difference between that sort of a situation and this is the privilege. Here we're talking about victims who are seeking treatment for something that happened to them in particular, in cases like this, that is alleged to have happened by occurred because of the defendant. These are intimate details of a very personal nature that are being discussed with a therapist. That's entirely different from someone who is simply afraid that the information that they're relaying is going to come back and there will be in physical danger. There's nothing personal, and there's nothing private other than trying to, you know, continue to be a drug dealer while you're ratting out another drug dealer type of thing. This is very different.
But as I understand it, it's not as if the defendant would get access to those discussions or notes from the therapist unless there was something in there, and only to the extent that there was something in there that was inconsistent with the position that the victim was taking at the trial.
The court, however, would be seeing those documents. The court staff would be seeing those. That record might be sealed, and it would go up to see if the court had, in fact, found that. There are a lot of eyes that would see that information, and it would have a severe chilling effect on the very people that should be and need to seek treatment. There's also...
So you're saying that even if the information is never revealed to the defendant or never revealed in a trial, even that just the in-camera review is intrusive?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, suppose, the problem here is that it's almost impossible to know and therefore to demonstrate that the notes may have information that would call for, at the very least, an in-camera review. Suppose, for example, the notes indicated that during the victim's interview with the psychiatrist, she told the psychiatrist that she really couldn't remember who it was that committed the assaults upon her, even though, you know, she had told the law enforcement authorities otherwise. There's no way to know that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So wouldn't it be a prudent advisory, that is a prudent and advisable rule, to allow an in-camera review, or at least to have a presumption that there ought to be an in-camera review rather than the opposite?
The problem with that approach is that under that scenario, every victim that seeks treatment would be subject to having their therapist records reviewed in camera, every single one.
Suppose we were to conclude, contrary to the state's position, that there was error in not issuing the subpoena for purposes of an in-camera review. What would be the remedy?
The remedy would be to have the in-camera review and have the court determine whether there was, in fact, any exculpatory evidence in there. And if
you mean remand to the trial court for a post-conviction in-camera review?
Yes. Yeah. Or whether there would be harmless error. And in this case, particularly, the alleged inconsistencies that were the basis for the belief that there would be more inconsistent statements were never really in existence. There were discrepancies between witnesses, and each witness themselves was consistent. They were consistently vague. So in that sense, it was not clear. They were never clear on how old they were. But the fact that other witnesses were reporting that, well, I'm not sure, I think they may have said they were this age, or whether they were awake or asleep. And the witnesses that were allegedly reporting and demonstrating inconsistencies all went to the older girl victim, and all of those charges the defendant was found not guilty, or it was hung. He was not convicted of any charges relating to her.
Tell us again what role you're advocating under the facts of this case, where it's treatment after the fact, not part of an investigation, not part of any medical treatment. You started out by saying if there was evidence of recantation, maybe that would be enough for in-camera review. You made some reference to inconsistencies, but now your latest remarks seem to move away from inconsistencies, or say that these inconsistencies didn't meet the threshold. But in this particular case, what would the defendant need to demonstrate to justify an in-camera review?
In this case, the state would contend there he could not have reached that.
I know.
In that,
well, hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
What could anybody do in a similar situation to, you know, cross the threshold and require an in-camera review?
If they could produce a witness who said that one of these victims told me that it didn't actually happen, that would be certainly meet the threshold. Two, if they had evidence that either of the victims had been treated for in the past for something that affected their ability to testify correctly. Either of those situations would certainly rise to the level of an in-camera review. Short of that, the state would contend they could not reach that that burden. If the court has no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A couple of points. I think it's important to look at what the prosecutor said when she undid the curative instruction. And what she said was the only person responsible for the hurt and the pain and the emotional trauma that you witnessed in this courtroom. The fact that she would reference any trauma at all for the jury to consider, that's problematic in and of itself. But what the state wants to do is parcel out what she was referencing. If the prosecutor was only referencing certain traumatic behavior, she would have said that. But she said all of the emotional trauma that you witnessed in this courtroom, That's everything. And with that statement, she essentially vitiated any remedial effect that the curative instruction had. Secondly, from Your Honor's questioning, I feel that the position that we've adopted is that the fact that it was calculated is why a mistrial is warranted. That's not the only reason. Even if this was not calculated, what happened subsequently and the other Taylor factors also requires reversal. The fact that the witness did not, whether or not he intended to violate the appellant's right to a fair trial is not what's important. It's the effect. He intended to confront the witness, but the effect was a violation of his trial rights. And lastly, we understand that a defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial, but he is entitled to a fair one. And that's what he didn't get here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.